It's Wednesday, September the 23rd, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. With me today are political editor Pat Leahy and political reporter Jennifer Bray, who is back and, if not tanned, at least relaxed from our holidays. Is that right, Jay?
Yeah, I'm very relaxed. I never get a tan because I'm a redhead. But yeah, it was nice to get a couple of days off. I think the zen feeling lasted for around 2 hours, but at least, you know, at least it lasted 2 hours.
Well, welcome back to the bleakness of Irish politics in the year 2020. I suppose we'll start with the fact, because in a way it illustrates where we're at, that a substantial amount of the cabinet is currently self-isolating, or at least refraining from full contact with other people.
Yeah, so this morning we learned that Leo Varadkar was informed that he was a close contact of someone who tested positive for COVID-19, and he will have to restrict his movements, which basically means work from home and exercise outdoors only. In terms of what you can do out and about. So he said he's feeling perfectly well and that he'll be continuing to do his job, but obviously it will be in a much more restricted fashion. We learned last night it was a similar case for Pascal Donoghue, and obviously we are well aware, of course, of what happened last week with Stephen Donnelly, and I believe, Pat, you were saying perhaps Simon Coveney as well is in the same boat.
Yeah, that's right. Simon Coveney was in Brussels for meetings, including one with Michel Barnier, but there was Foreign Affairs Council meeting and General Affairs Council meeting that he was in Brussels for. So I think the normal procedure is that he's tested before he goes, he's tested on return, and he'll be tested after a week as well. Now, it's not showing symptoms or anything like that, but this is the routine. Now, he's free to work in his department and free to be in Leinster House, but he is restricting, I'm told, his movements in terms of social interactions with people. So, yeah, it amounts to, what, a quarter of the cabinet that is currently restricting their movements. Three of them, I suppose, as a result of international travel and EU meetings. I think it was the French finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, who tested positive, and Pascal Donoghue, who met him at the Eurogroup meeting in Berlin last week. So that's why he's self-isolating. And I think as EU business gets up and running again, in terms of face-to-face meetings, we will probably see more of this. Although the European summit, the meeting of the heads of government that was supposed to take place in Brussels this Thursday and Friday, has been postponed for a week. So I think what you're seeing, I suppose, is normal government and EU business trying to get up and running, but facing, you know, the sort of difficulties that are likely to be with us for some time to come.
Well, indeed. And in fact, these are just fairly common sense precautionary measures, which are all pretty clear. They're in place now, Jen, aren't they? And, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure how much that kind of a restriction actually restricts the ability of those particular politicians to do their jobs. And I would also hazard a guess, and it's no more than a guess, that the circumstances in which, for example, that meeting in Europe took place last week were probably, you know, people were observing the protocols for such meetings in terms of social distancing and the other things which are required. So the odds are that there isn't a significant problem there. And this is just the world we're in now.
Yeah, you're right. This is the world we're in now. I think even this morning when it emerged, when Leo Varadkar sent out a statement that he had been in close contact with someone who tested positive, there wasn't even any surprise, or, you know, because I think if you remember back in March and back in April, when we had Irish political leaders and political leaders around the world who were in this exact circumstance, or perhaps testing positive, it was kind of a feeling of shock and, you know, what's going to happen and what's the backup plan and what's the plan B. And now it's kind of, I hate this phrase, but, you know, the new normal, it's the new reality, I suppose, and it's something you're going to have to get used to for a long while at least. And I would agree with you to a certain extent in that I think that they obviously can carry on with their business if they haven't tested positive. And even a lot of people, as we all know very well by now, who test positive might not have any symptoms. So what I'm saying is that you can still carry out your business as a government. You can still do your job as a minister, for example. But the one area that I think would suffer, and it's kind of natural that this would happen and it's not their fault, is in the area of transparency. Because if you have a minister, let's say Leo Varadkar was due to come out tomorrow, let's say this was around the time of the budget, to explain budgetary measures, give a press conference, answer questions from journalists. That obviously wouldn't happen. So, you know, it would be done probably through press releases, through whatever form that remote working will allow. It just means it dampens down the availability of any political leader or any TD, and therefore our opportunity to question them and maybe to get to the bottom of whatever issue is the issue of the day. That's not ideal, but it is the way it is. And I don't think, barring some kind of Zoom press conference or something, I don't think there really isn't very much that can be done about it, as far as I can see.
Yeah, I do wonder, why can't there be Zoom press conferences? I mean, is this a convenient screen, perhaps, for some politicians? It's perfectly possible to have a press conference with all the journalists who would be there in person participating in the same way.
I've actually wondered this myself, because we had an issue kind of going back a couple of weeks. You know, usually when there's a cabinet meeting afterwards, there's a kind of post-cabinet briefing, which will be done with political correspondents to tell them what was on the agenda and to explain decisions that were made at cabinet, which is obviously very important. And that sort of fell by the wayside for a couple of months. Now, in fairness, there was a new government being set up, new press officers being appointed, advisors, government press secretaries, all that kind of stuff. They were only being put in place. So there was kind of an in-between period, but we're still kind of only getting back into the groove of that now. And you could definitely see a scenario whereby if cases continue to increase and we're all told to stay at home again, if the levels increase from 3 to 4 to 5, that could again fall by the wayside. And I think that this idea of Zoom meetings, and like we do for the podcast, and whatever other mechanism that you can have available through technology, should definitely be explored instead of just going back to the way it was before, which is everything's off the table and, you know, we go back to hitting the phone lines and harassing people over the phones 24/7, 9 a.m. till 10 p.m.
There's no reason why socially distanced press conferences can't take place. The post-cabinet briefing did so yesterday. I know because I was at it. It was completely spaced out in the press centre in government buildings, and the government press secretary and two assistant government press secretaries, or deputy government press secretaries as they are, sat at the top of the room. If ministers aren't doing press conferences, it's not because they can't do them either in a socially distanced way or on Zoom. It's because they don't want to face questions from the press. We see the opposition are out multiple times a day on the plinth to meet journalists, again in a socially distanced fashion, to get their message across. So, to be honest, I don't think the pandemic is an excuse for ministers not talking to the public and explaining what they're doing to the public. I also believe, actually, that in most cases it's in their interest to talk to the public, because that's their, you know, talking to the public through us is their means of getting their message out. If they don't do that, they may be sure that the vacuum will be filled by, you know, either hostile media commentary or by the opposition. So, you know, there's no reason at all that it shouldn't be done.
Having said all that, Pat, this is a time of year where traditionally there's a lot of furtive goings on under the hood when it comes to government, because it's when the real tough talk starts in terms of the negotiations between different departments and different ministers in the run-up to the budget. There was quite a lot of coverage yesterday about discussion about whether supports such as the pandemic unemployment payment and enhanced sick pay for people who don't have company sick pay, it needed to be ramped up. And you, in a piece in the newspaper this morning, framed those in terms of that kind of jostling for position in the pre-budget period.
Yeah, it's actually started a little bit later than you would normally expect. So the budget is on the 13th of October. So we're now 3 weeks away. It was 3 weeks away yesterday from that budget. And by now you would expect to be, you know, in the sort of heavy lifting of budget negotiations between the Department of Public Expenditure at the centre of government and the individual line departments, or the spending departments, as they haggle over their settlements for next year. And my understanding after a few conversations with people yesterday and this morning is that that process is only really getting going at this stage. So departments have put their bids in for a settlement for their spending ceiling for next year, beginning the process of horse trading between themselves and the centre. And that will go on for a period of a couple of weeks before those numbers are finally tied down in the week before the budget. So it's all a little bit truncated this year, perhaps not unexpected given the circumstances of the pandemic and so forth. Two other things I think to add on the budget process. The first is that coalition governments often find their first budget quite difficult. If you look back to the experience of recent coalition governments, particularly new coalition governments, then the whole experience of the horse trading, the dealing, the behind closed doors negotiations, the use of the media to fly kites to push particular agendas, all that tends to be a little more fractious, in my experience of covering these things, in the first year of a new government. After that, people kind of know what to expect and it settles down. So I think we will see some of that in operation over the coming weeks. The only thing to add in qualification to that, I think, is that the usual financial constraints are very different this year. So the government is going to borrow an absolute truckload of money next year to is borrowing this year and will borrow again next year to pay for the costs of the pandemic and the economic slowdown that that has accompanied it. So it's not that government has all the money to do everything that it wants this year. No government ever has that. But I think the sort of, you know, bitter scraps over 100 million here, 100 million there are less likely this year because of the vastly increased borrowing will ultimately loosen the purse strings quite significantly. Now, I know if people in the Department of Finance and people of the Department of Public Expenditure are listening to this, they'll be saying, Jesus, don't tell them that for crying out loud. But
too late.
And of course, all the spending departments and the line departments will go in with bids vastly in excess of what they ultimately hope to achieve. But I don't think you will have, you know, that sort of grinding tightness that you have had in budgetary negotiations in the past.
The other part, Jen, that strikes me of this sort of quite last minute or late in the day approach to the budget this year is that we're in a situation of great flux and not just uncertainty, but kind of a change in the mood over the last 4 to 6 weeks. The government was previously, if not on a glide path and kind of laying out a narrative of gradual recovery over the next, you know, 6, 8, 10 months, bits of the economy, you know, getting back up and working again over the course of the summer. And now we've gone into a kind of a screeching reverse in some areas, in Dublin at the moment, possibly in other parts of the country in the next couple of weeks, and certain industries and businesses which were looking forward to starting up now aren't going to be starting up. And that raises lots of questions about things like the reduction of the unemployment payment. If you're saying to people, well, this is still a crisis and we're not letting you go back to work.
Yeah, I think things are still very, very unpredictable in terms of the health situation. Obviously, that has a huge knock-on impact on the financial situation, which makes it difficult to forecast with any full degree of certainty exactly, I suppose, what will be needed next year, this year and into next year when you're thinking about Budget 2021. And in fact, I think Michael McGrath spoke to the Cabinet yesterday and told them that they're going to need 1 billion in measures that have already been committed to. They're going to need 900 million just to meet current spending pressures, and they're going to need 9 billion at least in COVID spending. And that figure actually struck me as quite small when you look at the supplementary budgets and the extra cash that has already been put aside for different departments in Dáil votes this year. So that just gives you an idea of kind of the pressures that I suppose he's under, that the government's under, different departments are under. And yeah, you're right, like we're at a time now where there was a bit of optimism over the summer, really, wasn't there, that things were getting a bit better? There was a bit of a lull. There was a lot of talk about a second wave, but now the second wave appears to be here and it's quite frightening. And I think that the timing for the government in terms of their decision to cut the pandemic unemployment payment has come days really after new restrictions had to be put in place in Dublin. And we are, it is expected that there will be other restrictions placed on up to between six to eight other counties in the next week or two if the figures keep going in the wrong direction. There's a lot of concern about cases in Cork. There's a lot of concern about cases in Louth, Wicklow, Waterford, Donegal. So, you know, those counties are kind of looking now to the figures and anticipating that. And obviously that has a knock-on impact on business. So when you have on one hand the PUP, the pandemic unemployment payment, being cut to €300 a week for those who earned over €300 per week before the pandemic, you know, the timing isn't great. And there is a lot of pressure on government now to restore the PUP to the level it was previously at. I've spoken to different industry groups yesterday and their message was it has to be restored. It's not a matter of when, but it has to happen. And I think this is the pressure they'll come under in the budget to basically fine tune the schemes that they had in place for the pandemic. So you're talking about the temporary wage subsidy scheme, which has migrated into a new form, which will exist until the end of the year and then up until April next year. So currently under that scheme, a business can apply for a flat rate subsidy if there's been a reduction in turnover up to 30%. And I think they'll come under pressure to fine tune that, because what will happen for businesses who have a reduction in revenue of 29% or 28%, 27%, it's kind of a cliff edge for them. So I think that in the budget, there'll be a lot of focus on graduating those schemes, perhaps looking at the pandemic unemployment payment again, because the political pressure in terms of that will only increase. And we saw it yesterday in Dáil, we'll see it all throughout this week. And if we are facing another situation where we're moving towards level four, or maybe even moving back towards a nationwide level five in the worst case scenario, then they, you know, they will definitely have to relook at those schemes again.
And the level of noise around that was only enhanced by announcement of special advisors. I want to talk about special advisors, but actually, first, I just want to say that if you'd like to support this podcast and the journalism of the Irish Times, please go to irishtimes.com/inside. And if you haven't done so already, you can sign up there for unlimited access. And using that particular address, irishtimes.com/inside, allows us to know how many of our subscribers are also listeners to Inside Politics, which is good for us here on the podcast. And indeed, if you are a listener to podcasts, you'll be particularly interested in our current offer of a free pair of Sennheiser wireless headphones if you purchase a premium weekend or complete subscription. All the information is at irishtimes.com/inside. Now, Pat, special advisors.
Yes, nothing guaranteed to raise the hackles of media and opposition more than the appointment of special advisors. You will also notice a pattern, of course, that oppositions that are outraged by the level of the numbers of special advisors that are appointed when they're in opposition tend to become miraculously convinced of their merits when they enter government themselves. So as Jen was reporting yesterday morning, Cabinet approved the appointment of 10 special advisors for junior ministers. Now, every senior minister has a special advisor and a press advisor or a press officer that they can appoint. And you know, just in case people are unfamiliar with the nature of the work that they do, these are in addition to the civil servants that work in a minister's private office and in the rest of the department. So they work kind of specially and personally for that minister's agenda on policy work, on programme for government implementation, on cross-government work and on media work. So every cabinet member has two of those advisors. Junior ministers were initially, again, as Jen reported yesterday, not supposed to have their own special advisors. There was a pool of advisors that were supposed to be available to work for junior ministers, but that decision was abandoned yesterday and it was decided that 10 of the 17 normal junior ministers, excluding the three super junior ministers, I hope you're keeping up here, Hugh, excluding the three super junior ministers who already have special advisors, but 7 out of the, 10 rather, out of the remaining 17 junior ministers would have their own advisors. They were the ones who had made a compelling case for the appointment of their own advisor to the Department of Public Expenditure. Now, this leaves, of course, 7 junior ministers without an advisor. And the question is posed by, I think was posed by Miriam Lord this morning, as to whether this is because they are so able that they don't need advisors, or whether they're so useless that they couldn't make a compelling case to the Department of Public Expenditure. All of this
is
good knockabout
stuff.
We would have to go through that, as they say, Hugh, on a case-by-case basis.
Pat, I think you should. I think you should. I've got the names here if you want to go through them on a case-by-case basis.
Useless or brilliant, you decide.
Yeah. Some of them definitely useless. Some of them definitely brilliant. The point I was going to make is that this is all good knockabout stuff for those of us in the kind of political and media bubble. It was also, given the timing of the announcement yesterday, on the day that the pandemic unemployment payment was cut for many people by 50 euros a week, an act of gross political stupidity in its timing at least. And it provided the Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, with an open goal, and she duly slotted the ball into the net at leaders' questions. And you will see the clip of Mary Lou MacDonald contrasting the government hiring, you know, more advisors for itself with the cuts to people's unemployment benefit on your Facebook feed and in your timeline, as Sinn Féin does very effectively. So,
although to be fair, Micheál Martin did have not a bad riposte. He pointed out the extreme fondness of Sinn Féin in government in Northern Ireland for as many special advisors as possible. In fact, arguably, Northern Ireland is a place that's run by special advisors.
Yeah, and we've spoken to Sam McBride from the newsletter in the past about that. I think there's a lot of truth in that, but I refer my learned friend to my earlier comments about the miraculous conversion that opposition parties tend to have of the merits of special advisors when they enter government.
Jen, actually, before I ask you the question, I just point out that I'm sure a lot of listeners know that there are at least two former regular contributors to this podcast, two former members of the political team, who are now special advisors to the current government, or press advisors, or one or the other. I wonder about...
They're dead to us now. Dead to
yeah,
us.
They are.
Dead.
They are. I'm not even going to mention their names. I do wonder, I mean, the press advisors in my day-to-day life would be the ones I would deal with more. And I'm always slightly flummoxed by the fact that there's a press advisor to a minister, and then there's a whole press office of civil servants as well. And I do sometimes ask myself, why is this necessary?
Well, I think they'd perform two different functions, to be honest with you. I think obviously a press office in a department, to my mind anyway, will deal with kind of regular queries that come in that will be department specific and probably agnostic to whatever minister is in or out. So it's kind of the civil service element of it. Whereas, to my mind, a ministerial advisor to a specific person works with them on a much closer basis. They would deal a lot with political correspondents and those working in Leinster House to field kind of very specific questions, often quite late at night or very early in the morning, which you wouldn't get from a press office who work kind of more regular hours. And the questions could be more sensitive. They could be more time sensitive. And I do think that the role that's performed by both is quite different. Now, critics would say, I know critics would say that those who carry out the role of media advisor to the government perhaps are, to their mind, maybe performing a role that could be seen to be to the betterment of the minister. But really, it's to communicate.
Spin, Jen, spin. Spin. Let's
Sorry,
be frank
I was,
here.
I was looking for the word, you know. This is 2 weeks off and I forget.
No, but the argument is it's not a public service. It's a political service to the
yeah.
politician.
Well, that's the argument, yeah. But I think that the role that they provide is a little bit broader than that, and certainly is a lot more unsociable. And it's to take calls from people like myself and Pat at ungodly hours about probably very specific things that need an answer immediately and that need to be clarified immediately, especially during a pandemic where the whole way that we work has changed and the news cycle has changed. And when information gets out that is incorrect, it's damaging to the government. Is really not helpful for us, and it's not great for our readers or listeners. So I think they do a role that's a little bit more specific and that's a little bit more unsociable, to be honest with you.
I mean, Pat is right, though, isn't he, when he says it's yet another blunder to add to the long list of blunders of this government, the way the timing and everything else was handled yesterday.
Yeah, I think so. And What I've been told, and I'm always open to correction, is that there was a meeting of comms heads of the government yesterday. Usually you'd have like advisors meetings and all that, and they'd discuss communications, and that there was one such meeting yesterday, and that it wasn't raised, the potential for this to look bad, which I found extraordinary, because it just seems such an obvious thing, doesn't it? You're appointing 10 advisors a day after, or on the day of, the PUP has been cut. And, you know, we know from the figures that came out in relation to the pandemic unemployment payment that the demand is still there. I think the figures on the PUP only dropped by around 3,000 week on week. And that was before you take into account the new restrictions that were put in place in Dublin. So it's not like this payment isn't being used. It's not like this payment isn't needed. And I think that the optics of that, to me, if speaking of advisors, like if I was an advisor, you'd kind of look at that and say, that's a bad idea. Can we do that some other time?
Suggests to me that some of the special advisors may not be so special after all.
Apart from our former colleagues, I'm sure they're very special.
I mean, that there is, I mean, Jen points out it is a complete irony there, isn't it? That all these people are employed to smooth the path of the government, to make sure it doesn't put a foot wrong, to be strategically nimble and to get the message out with greater clarity. And this is what we get as a result?
It's crazy. It just seems like another own goal. And you could have absolutely put that off another week. Like, just because Cabinet doesn't approve advisors doesn't mean they can't do their job. You know, often there's a really long time lag between an advisor being appointed and being paid and getting into their role and actually being approved by Cabinet. Like, so to me, it just seemed completely bizarre and really odd timing. You'd wonder, but like, this is what we've become accustomed to, really, to be honest with you. Like, we've become accustomed to kind of these bizarre things where you think, did nobody see this coming?
Pat, I just want to turn to as well an interesting political development this week. And you sort of a coalition in local government in Dublin between Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin, supported by the People Before Profit and Solidarity, quite an interesting rainbow, a new form of rainbow coalition, who all decided collectively to not to increase local property tax, which has been stuck at quite a very low level based on out-of-date valuations of houses in Dublin for several years now. Now, Dublin's in serious financial trouble as a result of the pandemic. Its revenues are way down on a number of different fronts and the calls on its services are increased. But this was of little concern, it seems, or not sufficient concern to the councillors of all those respective parties. I note that the Irish Times today, in an editorial, is most displeased by this.
Yes. So the way the local property tax works is there's a base rate set and local councils can decide to reduce that by 15% or to increase it by 15%. So every year the Dublin City Council has voted to reduce it by 15%. The executive, the officers, the non-elected executive leadership of the council led by Eoin Keegan, city manager, wanted to increase it from the base rate by 15%. The councillors voted along the lines, along the party lines you suggested earlier, to keep the maximum 15% reduction. So there will be a significant shortfall in the budget. So the city council will either have to reduce its expenditure or increase its revenues from other sources, and their first port of call would, of course, be central government to look for additional resources. In all likelihood, what will happen is a combination of both. Some services will be cut, and some additional revenues will be given from central government, which is already guaranteed to pay the contribution of lost business rates to central government, I think, which is a commitment that's costing about 500 million in the first couple of months that it was that it was in operation. So I suppose more interesting is the ideological coalition the curious ideological coalition, which crosses party lines and goes to show that parties of the far left are just as opposed to tax increases as parties of the centre and centre right. I remember discovering this, or having this reinforced, several years ago when I rang the People Before Profit TD, Richard Boyd Barrett, to see if he wished to be quoted in condemnation of the government's, the then government's budgetary decision to cut capital gains tax and our capital acquisitions tax. And he was strangely reluctant to do so, and pointing out, of course, that many owners of ordinary homes in his constituency of Dunleary would be over the threshold for capital gains tax. Lucky them, you might think, and therefore shouldn't they be prepared to pay some of this windfall into public coffers to pay for the social services that Deputy Boyd Barrett and many of his colleagues would constantly advocate for? But I'm afraid not. And I think I mean I'm not sure about this, but I think they must be the only radical socialist party to be against taxes on wealthy property. But there you are. Welcome to Irish politics.
Yeah, well, that's it exactly. We should say that the Social Democrats, the Labour Party and the Greens, while they didn't necessarily agree with Owen Keegan's proposal of a 15% increase, went some of the way on it. So they weren't in favour of this full 15% reduction. Jen, I was trying to explain this to a foreign observer of Irish politics a few weeks ago, and I found it very difficult to explain this particularly Irish form of low-tax left-wing politics. It's something I seem to recall that we saw in some of the research into the votes in the run-up to and after the recent general election, that I recall a number that Sinn Féin voters, for example, were very, very against tax in general and wanted to see tax cuts, which is not normally what you'd associate with the largest left-wing party in the country, self-described.
No, it isn't, is it? And I can understand your frustration at having to explain these sort of anomalies to your international friend. But, you know, Irish politics hasn't always aligned traditionally the way I suppose you would expect, or traditionally the way politics has aligned in other European countries. And, you know, it's for a number of different reasons. But I think that, and this could be me being cynical, a lot of it is kind of not populist, but it is playing to the base of the party. And, you know, there'll be a lot of research done as to what are the vote winners and what will work with the party base. And I think that's just what we're seeing played out. And the issue with property tax has been a hot potato for such a long time, and it's been put off and put off and put off and frozen. And I thought this would be the year that they would have to address it. When we actually spoke about this time last year on the podcast, I remember saying to you that next year they're going to have to deal with this and it's not going to be pretty. And now we see this happening again. So it's, you know, it's one of those issues that just keeps getting kicked. The can just keeps getting kicked down the road. And I, you know, it will have to be dealt with eventually, because we've had multiple reports into a Thornhill report and whatnot.
That's what we said last year.
Yes.
And
we'll
the
say it again
before.
Next year.
God, that's Irish politics for you. Finally, Pat, I mean, the thing that strikes me, how I ended up explaining this was to say, well, don't pay any attention to the parties. Pay attention to the voters. They're to blame. They're all on the same side on this. They're not prepared to have higher taxes for better services. And they're not particularly taken by wealth taxes of any sort, and particularly on their most beloved form of wealth and the main form of wealth and assets in this country, property.
Yes, we've been here before, though, Hugh. In defence of the voters, which is, in fairness, a position I rarely find myself occupying, I'm not sure it is true to say that they are opposed to higher taxes for better services. In fact, polls tend to show that if they believed they were going to get better services for the higher tax for higher taxation, then many of them would be prepared to contemplate that. But they're not convinced that they will get better services for higher taxes, and so they make the and if that is their view, then it is of course perfectly rational to oppose higher taxes. You know, the bigger picture is that services have to be paid for. that's not a political or ideological view. It is a fact it's a fact of economic life. It's a fact of arithmetic, really. What politics is often about, in its essence, is deciding who should pay for that and in what proportions, and deciding not just how big the pie is, but how how the slices of that pie should be dispersed, but also how people should contribute to the ingredients that make that pie, if that's not to stretch the metaphor beyond breaking point or crumbling point, I suppose. This is a version of the most basic of political debates. But as is often the case in Irish politics, it doesn't actually want to engage in that debate. It wants to have a phony debate that pretends that you can have infinite services paid for by somebody else. So in that respect, I suppose, despite our editorial and our coverage today, there's nothing remotely surprising about what happened at Dublin City Council the other night.
Yeah, I'm going to stick to my explanation, which is the Irish people are a bunch of lying hypocrites. On that happy note, I'm going to leave it there. That's it for today's podcast. Thanks to Pat. Thanks to Jen for joining us. Thanks also to our producer, Suzanne Brennan, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. If you want to get in touch with us, we're always really happy to hear from you. Just email us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. But until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.